This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
Welcome once again to the Doctor's Lounge. I'm your co-host, Dr. Mike Karuchek. As you know, I alternate weeks with my co-host, Dr. Hal Schertz, here on the Doctor's Lounge. The Doctor's Lounge is sponsored by the Docs for Patient Care Foundation. We support freedom of choice in healthcare. We support the reduction of regulations so that you and your doctor can make free, unencumbered medical decisions with as much information as possible, not only medical information, but cost information as well. And to that end, we have a very, very special guest today that I had the privilege of meeting in Washington, D.C. a couple of months ago. This is Mr. David Goldhill. He is the CEO of the Game Show Network, but he has written a very, very practical, useful, intelligent book on what's wrong with healthcare called Catastrophic Care: Why Everything We Think We Know About Healthcare Is Wrong. David, thank you so much for being with us.
Mark, thanks for having me on today.
Very interesting. I think the first question folks need to know is how do we connect the dots from someone who is a CEO of a large corporation to someone who's become one of the most intuitive and respected authors in what's wrong with healthcare? I think that's a worthwhile story.
Well, first of all, thank you for the very kind remarks about my book. The connection comes, as it does for most people, by having had an interaction with the healthcare system. In my case, it was my father's death from an infection he acquired in the hospital in 2007. It first got me interested in healthcare, and it wasn't obviously my initial response. My initial response was about the grief you can imagine that you feel and the confusion you feel when, somebody seemingly healthy is admitted for observation and then within 24 hours is ill with something that he wound up never leaving the hospital from. And I think the key factor for me was finding out roughly a month after my dad's death that his type of death was very common. At the time, the estimate was there's somewhere around 100,000 Americans who die every year from hospital-acquired infections, a number I had no idea about. And that I think what's more alarming was a piece that I saw in the New Yorker in the month following his death by Atul Gawande, in which Atul spoke about efforts to reduce these infections, including a series of fairly simple protocols that a well-known patient safety expert had been pitching to hospitals for a couple years, trying to get them to adopt, that had been shown to reduce this death rate by two-thirds to three-quarters, cost almost nothing to implement, and was having real trouble getting any hospitals to pay attention. And I think that's where, when you look for connections in my professional career, in my work on healthcare, that's where it really kicked in, because I said to myself, well, I don't understand that. Why are there not incentives to cause hospitals to reduce death rate? What does it tell us about our healthcare system that there's a way to reduce this extraordinarily high death rate, and it's not being adopted by hospitals? And that really is the start for so much of what I've written about healthcare, which is really understanding what the incentives we built into the system are, and understanding where there aren't disincentives that we see in other parts of the economy. Most parts of the economy, we have a real disincentive against killing your customers, and asking why are they so different in healthcare.
So, as I understand it, the method was actually a very inexpensive, very practical thing that no one could get the caregivers interested in. And ironically, the fact that it was easy and inexpensive may have been the very reason.
Well, it couldn't be billed for. But I think, more importantly, what I realized is that from the hospital's point of view, killing my father, or not being careful enough to avoid killing my father and all the other parents and loved ones that suffered these fates, may be related to the fact that they get paid whether or not their results are good. And in this case, whether or not there's an accidental or error rate that or error that explains a really bad result. And I suspect, one thing I want to be very careful, this is not about evil. One of the simple things we do that I think distorts our understanding of healthcare is we're always looking for villains. Who's to blame? And in fact, the argument I'm making is a more systemic one, which is if you're going to pay any industry fundamentally the same, whether or not the product is successful or unsuccessful, the incentives to invest in success are less. And that's the type of business analysis people very rarely use when they talk about healthcare, right? They think healthcare must be so different from the way everything else is. And if you look at the fundamentals of the analysis I've tried to do, it skips that, right? It says, look, I assume healthcare is like any other human activity, and incentives really matter, and people aren't, you know, angels or villains. They're just people. And then if you're going to build a massive industry around incentives, like in everything else, you can look at those incentives and understand how we got to where we've gotten to. What happened with my dad was really a point of entry to me. It really gave me the opportunity to ask this question of, what type of incentives does healthcare as an industry face? How has it responded to those incentives? And how does that explain the enormous dissatisfaction I think we all feel, not just as it relates to safety, although certainly as it relates to safety, but also as to value and transparency and ease of use and access and universality and quality control and all the things that we complain about in healthcare, I argue, are not because the system is irrational or there's these awful villains somewhere or it's the Democrats or the Republicans or the unions or the doctors, whatever you like to argue, but in fact because, like in any complicated system, you have a industry that has responded to the incentives and disincentives that we've provided through the various ways we've paid for healthcare.
Well, one of the earliest concepts you put forth in the book, and it's like so many other moments reading this book where, you know, we who are getting into this, you know, rather late in the game as physicians trying to make a difference, and we say things like, well, the patients aren't the customers anymore. You know, the government is the customer. And you lay this out in the book with a concept called the surrogate, which says that basically, you know, any other economic transaction, the people who are paying are the people who actually receive the service. In healthcare, that's not true.
One of the advantages I've had as an analyst in this is that I've held a lot of different jobs, and all outside of healthcare. And one of the things you notice if you work in a bunch of different industries is that the companies in almost every industry respond to the needs of their customer. How do I keep my customer? How do I expand the amount of money I earn off a customer? One of the things we don't understand about the healthcare system, to your point, Mike, is who the customer actually is. We like to think the patient is the customer. But in fact, the customer is, you're right, in the book I call them surrogates, but they're the big third-party intermediaries. Insurers, for those of us who are privately insured, CMS for those on Medicare, state agencies for those on Medicaid, and those customers are who pays for healthcare. And what I think we find in healthcare is the entire industry is structured to serve those customers and their needs. And I guess one of the insights that, you know, my work has argued is that the difference between what a third-party intermediary requires of the healthcare system and what we as individuals would require as the healthcare customers is very, very large. People think that they can somehow substitute for our needs, but the example I give is, look, if you're Medicare and you're looking at 100,000 deaths from hospital-acquired infections, you're going to pay for them because you're basically the major customer of the hospital system. So if you don't pay for those infections, if you don't pay for the treatment of those who got the accidental infections, you're just going to have to pay more for those who didn't. You're going to pay the same amount of money to fund the hospital system regardless. If you're my mom and they kill your husband, you're not going to pay anything. You're going to refuse to pay. And just in that difference, in the way a big third-party institution treats its role as customers, and mom treats her role as customers, explains a lot of the difference between why the theory of healthcare is supposed to work and how the reality of healthcare's work has gotten so different, has gotten so wide.
So you bring up in the book the concept between the island and the mainland, and the island being sort of everyone who is in healthcare, physicians included. And so, you know, as I read this book, I've got to pull myself off the island and onto the mainland where everybody else behaves by, you know, truly the set of rules that, you know, the whole world outside of healthcare has to follow. And as a result, you have to change your thinking, I think, about how, you know, like you said, the incentives that drive healthcare, the forces that drive healthcare. I think where I see it the most in my world are two places. The first is in health information technology, and you have some comments to make about that in the book as well.
Well, that's right, and it is a very good example of how what I call island thinking differs from mainstream thinking. I mean, the entire economy, everything we see around us, has been transformed by information technology. And everyone uses it, right? Your auto mechanic uses it, your dry cleaner uses it, the corner grocery uses it.
Yes.
And at the beginning of the Obama administration, there was this recognition that there's only one industry that doesn't really use information technology, and that's healthcare. And by the way, it's used on the billing side, which is important, just not on the treatment side, not to keep patient records, not to allow the easy portability of test results and your health history from one provider to another, from one healthcare situation to another. And, you know, rather than do what I think we would do on the mainland, which is to say, that's kind of strange. What incentives explain or disincentives explain why healthcare and only healthcare has not adopted information technology? We did what we do in so many things in healthcare, which is we just assumed it must be different. There must be absolutely nothing we can learn from Walmart and your auto mechanic and your local grocery store. Healthcare must be different. And so what did we do? We said, all right, look, the federal government will pay for all providers to have information technology and to keep health records that individuals at some point could use. And that should be extremely efficient because we know how efficient health information is. And to make sure they do it, we're going to have this very complex series of rules called the meaningful use rules,
yes,
which they will be required to use as they use information technology that the government is paying for. Very famously, the study on which this policy was based argued that if you insisted the whole industry use information technology and you paid for it, the efficiency returns would be somewhere around $80 billion a year. Sounds like an enormous amount of money.
Yeah, that was that range.
But the cost was high, too. The cost was $40 billion. But $40 billion to achieve $80 billion of savings sounds so compelling. How could you not say yes to that? Now, again, if you were off the island, you would recognize something right away, which is, wait a minute, what industry, particularly one with $3 trillion of revenues every year, wouldn't find $40 billion one time to get $80 billion a year of savings? That just makes no sense. Who earns 200% on their capital and chooses not to do it? But we never, ever use mainstream analysis in looking at the healthcare industry, so we passed what's called HIT, which is health information technology. We're putting up the $40 billion, and it's not working. Why is it not working? Because we didn't understand the reason that healthcare providers didn't invest in information technology. And the reason they didn't invest in information technology, we only would have known if we looked at it as any other industry, which is, I guess, there's nobody in healthcare who can ever benefit from greater efficiency, lower prices that comes from competition.
We're going to break right there, and we're going to pick you up mid-sentence. We're at a hard break. You're listening to The Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio.
The Docs for Patient Care Foundation is your way to join the fight and become a member of an organization created by doctors for patients, dedicated to fighting for your healthcare freedom and preserving the doctor-patient relationship. Get a pen and paper. Write down docsforpatientcarefoundation.org. That's D-O-C-S, the number 4, patientcarefoundation.org. Go to our site and please make a generous tax-deductible donation and join the fight today. Thank you.
Did you miss a show that you really wanted to hear? All of our programs are available for download on AmericasWebRadio.com and on iTunes. You can listen to your favorite programs on americaswebradio.com anytime you like.
The Docs for Patient Care Foundation is your way to join the fight and become a member of an organization created by doctors for patients, dedicated to fighting for your healthcare freedom and preserving the doctor-patient relationship.
I'm Dr. Mike Karuchak, co-host of The Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio. Please join us in the fight to save the doctor-patient relationship. Get a pen and paper and go to this website, www.docsforpatientcarefoundation.org. www.docsforpatientcarefoundation.org.
This is americaswebradio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
We are back. You are listening to The Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio. I'm your host for this week, Dr. Mike Karuchak. Thank you very much for spending time with us. We have a very special guest, David Goldhill, the CEO of the Game Show Network, and for us, the author of a very, very important, very, very insightful book called Catastrophic Care, Why Everything We Think We Know About Healthcare Is Wrong. And we were talking about the impact of perverse incentives on the adoption of health information technology, and talking about why it is that an industry that could spend $40 billion to get $80 billion in savings, somehow that just didn't work out.
Yeah, and I, the point I was making is that it didn't work out because we didn't understand the reason it hadn't happened in the first place. We accepted the usual healthcare thing, which is there's this problem, we need to fix it on a top-down basis, as opposed to what I'm arguing is you need to understand where it comes from first. And the reason I talk so much about looking at the mainland is I think, look, when you look at how dry cleaners adopted information technology, it wasn't because Congress ordered them to. It wasn't because they're famously technology adopters, early adopters. It's because the dry cleaner across the street had information technology. And if I didn't invest, my customer thought less of me. I had a greater chance of losing, you know, their laundry, and it would be harder to retain customers. In other words, I had an economic incentive to do it. One of the troubling things about healthcare that this entire evolution in information technology should have told us is that, in fact, nobody had enough economic incentive in the system anywhere to save money, to be more efficient. Because the reality is, again, it's nothing special about healthcare. On the billing side, that's all they use is information technology because, of course, on billing, there's an enormous incentive to save money, to be efficient, to manage things normally. And the actual provision of care, there was none. And rather than see that insight and say, okay, how do we fundamentally change the incentives, we did what we usually did in healthcare, which is to treat the symptom, which was an underinvestment in information technology. Now, that may sound okay until you find what's happened. What's happened is we're going to spend the $40 billion. We're more than halfway there. Most physicians argue that the system is extremely over-engineered, takes more time than it saves. And, of course, the key element for patients, which was records that were genuinely portable, that they had access to no matter where they were, what doctor they went to, what service they used, has been turned on its head. So that information technology, health records have wound up being yet another way in which big institutions can avoid competition. And, you know, I think the problem is too few of the people who are experts in healthcare choose to understand it as an industry. And so they wind up, in a sense, to use a medical metaphor, they wind up just treating the symptom and often increasing the underlying problem.
Well, I would argue, in addition to all that, which I totally agree with, is that there was also perverse incentives for the healthcare vendors, for the EMR and the EHR vendors, because with meaningful use incentives in place, again, top down, like you're talking about, that they had no incentive to provide value. That, again, it's the same thing you're talking about, except it's a little bit from a different perspective, because the EMR vendors needed to have patients and doctors as their customers, and instead they, like big healthcare institutions, have government as their customer, and so the incentives are make your system certified, and it doesn't matter if it's a piece of garbage, as long as it's certified, there will be by legislative fiat customers lining up at the door.
Well, and it's you know, to further your point, Mike, it's the type of fiat they have, right? So if somehow we had a way of saying, look, if you can actually show value creation or money saving, we will increase the fees we pay to you and leave it open-ended for a dynamic to exist. We might have had a very different result in information technology, even with the federal involvement, in that what you would be fighting for is value creation. Now, how you measure it and all the rest, I don't know. But that's not what they did, right? What they said is the goal of information technology is to hit these process milestones. Now, if you've ever been in a business that adopted meaningful changes in information technology, you know that's the opposite of what you're trying to accomplish, right? You're not trying to accomplish essentially input goals. You're trying to accomplish output goals. And yeah. There is no easy way for government or a central authority of any kind, private or public, to measure those. And so the problem is, whereas if throughout the entire rest of the economy, we needed essentially no government action to encourage people to invest in technology that saved money, improved efficiency, improved service, improved reliability, in this industry, we never thought, are there ways to create those same incentives? We just said, as we always do, top down, let's fix this. And what we've wound up with is something that's very expensive and looks like it will achieve the opposite of our output goals, which was portability of records, ease of use, reduction of physician time on record keeping, improved communication between healthcare providers. Not only have none of those things been accomplished, almost, I would argue, those four are all moving in the opposite direction.
Oh, yeah. You wouldn't get any disagreement, in my world. I promise you that. I mean, we're all facing the reality that, you know, after we're done with a day of patients, we have to go home. And, it's nice to have remote access to the records, but it means your work never goes away because, you know, you're always, you know, catching up on charts that you didn't have time to finish. But,
there's something even bigger that you and I have talked about. We talked about not on the show, but we've talked about when we met before, that I think gets even more directly or more clearly to the audience at this point of trying to accomplish something, but the way you accomplish it, accomplishing the opposite. And that's how our insurance system works and the cost that it imposes on those that are being protected.
Oh, yeah.
We've built this idea that healthcare is something that's rare, major, and unaffordable for everybody, and so everyone needs to be covered by insurance. And that sounds very sensible. Except the problem is that, in fact, compared to most goods, healthcare is not that unpredictable over your lifetime. You're going to use a lot during a few years, especially towards the end of life. But everybody's likely to have at least one major healthcare crisis. And you're going to use a little, but a predictable little amount during other stages of your life, relatively little when you're young, a little more meaningful when you have, if and when you raise a family, that type of thing. Building an insurance system to cover the predictable and the unpredictable has done something very perverse. It means that the cost that almost everyone is bearing today is far more than we can imagine them bearing if they actually had to pay for their own health care. In other words, we built an insurance system, to use another metaphor, that's the equivalent of saying everybody over the course of their lifetime is going to pay insurance premiums equal to double the cost of their house burning down. Rather than our pooling our resources to protect a few of us whose houses burn down, we're going to make everyone pay as if their house had burned down twice. And that is what the sum total of our insurance system has done in the name of giving us security.
And basically what they've done is sort of hide these costs, you know, instead of it being sort of an in-your-face point-of-service payment. You do a great job with this example with a hypothetical Becky of showing how you start off at age 21 with your first job, and if you add everything up, that the number is a very significant multiple of significantly more, I think, than if you were just to pay for all your health care up front as you encountered it.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I think it's more than almost anyone can imagine. The study you're referring to is I actually looked at what a young employee here is likely to pay for health care over the course of her lifetime. So if she had her first job here and was earning an entry-level salary here and it grew at the 3%, that incomes tend to over the course of a lifetime, and you really added everything up. You really paid attention to everything that came out of her salary over her career to pay for health care. What does that mean? Her share of premiums, the company's share of premiums, her Medicare taxes, the share of state taxes that go to fund Medicaid, the amount she'll pay once she's in Medicare herself. If you add all those dollars up, and you don't have them, you literally use a zero inflation rate, so you're not playing with compound interest or anything, just absolute dollars.
Which, if anything, is going to make an underestimate. You're going to underestimate with that method.
I'm sorry?
And with those assumptions, you're going to end up underestimating, but go on. Yeah.
Yeah, well, so just add up everything that a young person starting out today is likely to have deducted from their paychecks or directly pay out of pocket or pay through taxes to cover health care. That number, assuming 0% inflation, is $1.2 million. $1.2 million. And this is a middle-class person, right? So this is somebody who, over the course of an entire career, we might expect to earn somewhere around $3.5 million gross, adding everything in. Almost just under a third of it is going to wind up one way or another paying for health care. What's perverse about that is, remember, the whole argument for the system we have is to protect people. And the point I make in the book is, by trying to protect everybody against everything, all we've done is push up the cost of everything. You know, I can protect you against your house burning down or having an auto crash, because those are rare things. But I actually can't protect you against having to eat every day. You're going to have to eat every day. And if I try to protect you against eating every day, all I've done is I've increased the cost of your eating every day, because I've got to add the cost of protection to the cost of your eating. We've done that in the healthcare system. And we can't see it, because every time we do a little more of it, every time we try to get someone else into the system, or we expand the number of things we're covering in the system, or, you know, otherwise subsidize things that we hadn't subsidized before, it looks like we're protecting ourselves, but all we're really doing is pushing up the cost of care we already know we need. And in trying to understand how the cost of health care in the United States went from 4% of GDP to almost 18% of GDP, if you're in healthcare, you try to talk about aging populations or technology, which in everything else, of course, reduces costs. Only in healthcare does it increase costs. Mm-hmm. Or all the other factors, but you can't help but notice that the biggest thing may be that we've taken all of the transactions out of healthcare, even those that are routine and expected or everybody bears, and we've built this massive third-party insurance infrastructure on top of them, which we all have to pay for. And so that when I looked at my young employee and added up and then went back to her and showed her the numbers, her response is what I suspect almost everyone's response would be, which is, you know what? I'd rather keep the money and pay for my own care.
Sure.
And I'm not suggesting we go to that system. What I'm suggesting is understanding that healthcare is not a single, rare, urgent, major good, but tens of thousands of different services, some of which are massively expensive and rare, and we want to protect people from. Some people are going to be very high healthcare spenders over their lifetimes because of things they're born with or struck with early in life, versus the things we know we are all going to have. Only then can we build a system where we can restore ourselves to the center as customers, and we've got the incentives right for value and safety and efficiency and all those other incentives we see in everything else we buy.
We're going to take a break. You are listening to The Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio.
The Docs for Patient Care Foundation is your way to join the fight and become a member of an organization created by doctors for patients, dedicated to fighting for your health care freedom and preserving the doctor-patient relationship. Get a pen and paper. Write down docsforpatientcarefoundation.org. That's D-O-C-S, the number 4, patientcarefoundation.org. Go to our site and please make a generous tax-deductible donation and join the fight today. Thank you.
Don't be hoodwinked by the left, who wants you to believe the fairy tale that we can power America on butterflies, rainbows, and pixie dust. I'm Marita Noon. Get the truth about energy on my show, America's Voice for Energy, only on America's Web Radio.
The Docs for Patient Care Foundation is your way to join the fight and become a member of an organization created by doctors for patients, dedicated to fighting for your healthcare freedom and preserving the doctor-patient relationship. Get a pen and paper. Write down www.docsforpatientcarefoundation.org. That's www.docsforpatientcarefoundation.org. Go to our site and please make a generous tax-deductible donation and join the fight today. Thank you.
This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
We're back. You are listening to The Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio. I'm your host, Dr. Mike Karuchak. We have with us today very special guest David Goldhill, author of the book Catastrophic Care, Why Everything We Think We Know About Healthcare Is Wrong. And we were talking about the fact that, you know, in a third-party payer system, David refers to this as a surrogate-based sort of payer system, that healthcare has become far more expensive and has gone from 4% of GDP up to 15 or 16% of GDP since 1966 when Medicare was enacted. But there's a devil's advocate question here, and then the question is that the capabilities of healthcare have changed, right? I mean, when in the 60s, physicians were almost largely spectators, with few exceptions. We would hold patients' hand until they either got better or they passed away. Now, you know, things like HIV, which used to be a death sentence, now it's a chronic disease, so obviously these people are living longer, it's going to be more expensive, and you can say the same thing with diabetes and heart disease and a host of other things. So what do we say to those folks, David?
Well, first of all, I think it's a very important point, which is that healthcare is not a static thing. It's a constantly evolving, constantly changing series of technologies and services and goods. The question is really, how do we build a healthcare economy like other economies, other industries, encourage good, useful value creation in innovation and not simply higher cost? So let me give you a couple of data points that may address that issue. First is that the one consumer-directed healthcare economy on Earth, in Singapore, achieves the same type of healthcare, the same services, the same level of quality that we do at under 4% of GDP. There's a lot of government intervention in Singapore, and I'm not suggesting that the healthcare industry doesn't need both government intervention, regulation, and support for those who for those who may be excluded for financial or health reasons. I believe in a universal safety net. It's just how you draw that safety net that I disagree with. But Singapore manages to achieve all this on less than 4% of GDP because the way their system works, there's no incentive to add to the cost base, just to add to the cost base. That has not been true in the American healthcare system or even in other healthcare systems where adding cost is a way to increase profitability. So we can achieve that level on much lower levels of spend. We've seen it in a country like Singapore. More importantly than that, I think we've got to be careful about confusing technology, progress, and cost. Right? In 1965, the year Medicare was passed was also the year the first mini-computer was introduced. So the first mini-computer cost $18,000. It was designed for companies, not for individuals. Nobody thought of computers as a home product in 1965. Healthcare, by contrast, had a per capita usage in the U.S. of $225 in 1965. So basically, the first mini-computer was 80 times more expensive than our average spending on healthcare. In the intervening years, so that's, you know, roughly 50 years, that mini-computer has been eclipsed by other technologies, obviously, and many of us who carry smartphones are carrying something that is far more powerful, far more capable, far more varied in its applications than that mini-computer was. The average price of a smartphone around the world last year was about $250. At the same time, healthcare is an average of $10,000 per person per year. Now, you can make a lot of distinctions between the computer industry and the healthcare industry. But one of the distinctions you cannot make is that one has had technological progress and the other has not. The issue in computers and in communication and in so much else we have is that technologies that improve quality, improve and expand the range of services, and do so at a lower price are heavily incented. And as a result, we have smartphones, which do things that people couldn't imagine even 10 years ago, much less 50 years ago. In healthcare, the technologies are favored are those that add to the cost base, because as we saw in information technology, technologies that can meaningfully drive efficiency, that can meaningfully lower costs, and very importantly, that can meaningfully improve quality and service, have no economic incentive. They're not adopted. So really what you're comparing is not one industry that uniquely has a technological opportunity to improve value but only at higher cost. What you're looking at is one industry, healthcare, that uniquely among almost any industry, we've given an incentive to add technology only when it increases costs, only when it makes it more expensive. And again, if you live on the island of healthcare, you say, well, we're just different than everything else. And if you live in the mainland, you say, huh, why do those people on the island believe that, gravity doesn't work there? Because there are plenty of healthcare technologies, and we're seeing many of them now in diagnostic care, that meaningfully reduce the cost of doing things while they increase quality, that the industry doesn't adopt because there's no economic incentive to adopt it. And that, not technology, is what really is driving up cost. And let me add one more point. The presumption in healthcare is a passive and incorrect one, which is that quality is constantly improving. I think when you spend time in the sector, what surprises you is that for $3 trillion, how little value we get. And by the way, this is nothing unique to the United States. It's been the case all over the world. Healthcare spending has grown, even though many of the improvements in health that we attribute to healthcare are in fact about public health and lifespans and diet and income. You know, it's interesting when we look at things like life expectancy. A country's healthcare system is relatively low. And the things that contribute to life expectancy, once you're a developed country, I'm only talking about the wealthy OECD countries as they're known. The things that really matter, disposable income, diet, exercise, stress, community safety, family life, all of those things are hurt by diverting ever more of our money into healthcare. So if the goal, and I think your devil's advocate question starts from this very correct goal, which is we want health to be better, doesn't that cost more money, is not necessarily achieved by putting more and more money into personal health care, and as we've seen in our country, doing so at the cost of disposable income, particularly for middle-class people.
Well, that's an important point, because we encounter in our discussions with folks, and you've heard this too, and it was a big part of when Obamacare was being discussed, is that people point to the U.S. and say, well, it's so expensive, yet our life expectancy in the United States is so poor compared to other countries. And so the point you make is so important is, look, life expectancy to a large degree has to do with personal choices, personal habits, you know, community resources that are available, rather than what happens when you go to the doctor.
So if you look at the OECD rankings, the United States and the UK are among the bottom of the rich countries in terms of life expectancy, even though obviously the UK has a very strong single-payer system and the US has a very different system. At the top of the rankings are countries like Japan and Italy and the Scandinavian countries, which have absolutely nothing in common in terms of how they approach healthcare. It really is, when you look at the determinants of life expectancy, forget what the politicians, you know, frankly, on both sides of the aisle say.
Yes.
The big issues tie much more closely to disposable income than they do to healthcare. And what we have to recognize is that the amount we're spending on healthcare has been a major tax on disposable income. I go back to that $1.2 million my, you know, newbie employee is going to wind up spending over her career for healthcare one way or another, whether she knows it or not. That is an enormous tax on the lifestyle she's able to create for herself and her family.
And correct me if I'm wrong, I think that model that you created didn't even include any deductibles or copays or anything that actually happens when you go to the doctor. Is that
well,
right?
Well, I did assume she never gets sick or significantly sick, and I did assume that her average out-of-pocket per year was relatively low as a result of that. You're right. If she's sick, it's more. You know, interestingly, if she has a working spouse of roughly the same income, together they're paying something closer to $2 million. If there's the normal health care inflation we expect, it's going to be in the $2.5 to $2.75 million. Regardless, the point is, it's an extraordinary amount of money. And if you had a home worth $200,000 and your insurance premiums, you know, essentially paid for that home every 10 years, you would notice. You would say, why am I insuring this house when I'm paying for it to be, you know, torn down, burnt down, blown down in a hurricane only every 10 years? That doesn't feel like insurance for me. Only in healthcare have we not noticed that that's what we've done to ourselves.
Well, why don't you – this might be a good place to go. One of the most compelling parts of the book, short as it was, like maybe a page or two, is the whole metaphor of the lemonade stand. Because sometimes a lot of this stuff, you know, you have to work pretty hard to get your mind around why incentives are doing bad things instead of good things until you hit the lemonade stand.
Right. Well, what I wrote about in the book was to imagine someone set a little girl in the neighborhood set up a lemonade stand to earn a little extra money, and she really didn't think through her economics, but she was charging about a dollar a cup selling, I can't remember what I used in the book as an example, but selling a certain number of cups a day, and then the mayor comes along and he's running for re-election, and he says, tell you what, I want to buy a cup for everybody in town. And what I tried to show is no matter how he structured how he paid her, he would change her incentive. So if he said, you know, I want everyone to have a cup in town for, and I'm willing to pay 50 cents a cup, her incentive then becomes to make the cups as small as possible, or alternatively, if he's figured that out, to reduce the amount of lemons per cup, right? If he then says, oh, well, wait a minute, you're watering down the lemonade, I want, you know, more lemons per cup. You know, she has a different set of incentives, right? She has, again, it depends entirely. Then actually, she has an enormous incentive to engage in a kickback scheme on lemons. If he says, forget it, I just want to pay you 10% above your costs, she has incentives to buy an extremely expensive lemonade-making machine and to figure out ways to get the family's dining table, which she uses as her lemonade stand, into the cost base. And rather than do the labor for free, she hires a third-party laborer to increase her cost base. That anything he said that was static, that was a rule, here's how I'm going to pay you, no matter how clever he thought it was, you know, cost plus or return on investment or fixed price per cup or fixed numbers of cups, it would change her incentives. It would change how she operated the lemonade stand. And that the only way to get the lemonade stand to charge a good value, to give her an incentive to keep her cost down and to keep her prices down, was competition. And the only way to have competition, of course, was not to have a fixed rule as to how you pay. And the metaphor of the lemonade stand was intended to illustrate a key point I think we forget about healthcare. We have some of the smartest people in the country working on figuring out the right thing to do in healthcare. What's the right way to pay for this? What's the right way to bundle those services? What's the right way to finance this? And the problem is the question of the right way is the wrong question. Because fixing the right way in an economy that involves human beings who respond to incentives just gives them an incentive to work their way around whatever rule you come up with. Doesn't matter how clever, how smart, how well thought out.
Well, and that's what smacked me right in the face. That's what smacked me right in the face because, you know, no matter what set of rules you come up with, people are going to come up with a way. I mean, maybe saying gaming the system is a little too harsh, but that got me thinking about, you know, drugs and medical devices and a bunch of other stuff. But we're at a break. We'll come back for the last segment. You're listening to The Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio.
In 2009, the membership organization Docs for Patient Care was founded. People all around the country wanted to participate in the efforts of this group, and they wanted to join, but they were unable to do so unless they were physicians. It's for this reason that the Docs for Patient Care Foundation was created. Now, everyone can join the fight and become a member of an organization created by doctors for patients, dedicated to fighting for your healthcare freedom and preserving the doctor-patient relationship. While you're at your computer, please go to www.docs.com. 4patientcarefoundation.org. That's www.docs4patientcarefoundation.org and make a tax-deductible donation and join the fight along with us. Thank you.
Did you miss a show that you really wanted to hear? All of our programs are available for download on americaswebradio.com and on iTunes. You can listen to your favorite programs on americaswebradio.com anytime you like.
The Docs for Patient Care Foundation is your way to join the fight and become a member of an organization created by doctors for patients, dedicated to fighting for your health care freedom and preserving the doctor-patient relationship. Get a pen and paper. Write down docs4patientcarefoundation.org. That's D-O-C-S, the number 4, patientcarefoundation.org. Go to our site and please make a generous tax-deductible donation and join the fight today. Thank you.
This is americaswebradio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
Welcome back. You are listening to The Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio. I'm your host, Dr. Mike Karuchak. We are with very special guest David Goldhill, author of the book Catastrophic Care, Why Everything We Think We Know About Healthcare Is Wrong. At the end of the last segment, we were talking about, to me, was one of the strongest metaphors in the book, which is, you know, if your daughter, and I have a 14-year-old daughter, could have done this a few years ago, you know, opens a lemonade stand on the street and wants to sell lemonade and kind of, you know, picks a price that, you know, you can make something as simple as selling lemonade not only tremendously complicated but tremendously expensive if, you know, someone comes along and wants all the lemonade business but wants to control your price.
Yeah, and the metaphor is really about something I think we don't often get in healthcare. I mean, it's very easy to say, look, the people in government, they're just not smart, they don't get it. In fact, my experience is the opposite. They're really smart. But what they believe is that smart is good enough. And what we believe in a market-based economy is that nobody's ever that smart. That what's smart is this sort of endless dynamic of competition and people's incentives playing out against each other. The lemonade stand was intended to show how no matter what rule you come up with for how to pay for lemonade, if you're buying all of it, as my fictitious mayor buying lemonade for everybody in the town was, once you're buying all of it by a rule, no matter what the rule is, you change the incentives of the lemonade stand, wind up meaningfully increasing costs in every circumstance, no matter what the rule is, and often reducing quality. And it's an argument for healthcare because I think often in healthcare, you'll hear some problem. For example, fee-for-service is a big problem. And some very smart people will say, here's how to fix fee-for-service. But what they've really done is they've taken a watch that stopped, and they've just reset it for our current time. But it's set again, so it's going to be wrong in a minute. Because, remember, healthcare's tens and tens of thousands of goods and services and 315 million customers, which we're increasingly realizing are very, very different from each other. So you have this extraordinarily complex thing that you're trying to solve through rules, and it may be comforting to people that somebody smart out there is doing it, but the reality is you're missing the most important engine of innovation and quality control we have, which is competition, feedback loops, and dynamic action, and you're replacing it with something static. My point in the lemonade stand was that something static will always lead to a bad result. It is inevitable. And it's something I think was surprising to people in the healthcare world to think of it that way. I get that lemonade stand quoted more than anything else because, you know, I literally have people say, well, what if the mayor came up with this rule for paying for healthcare? And then I've got to show them why that rule will inevitably lead to other dysfunctions and other quality problems and other pricing problems. And I think it really is a good metaphor for healthcare where people are seriously trying to solve problems, but for something this big and this heterogeneous, it's almost impossible. I mean, you know, we've had electric utility regulation for over 100 years. It's a single product delivered the same way everywhere in the country, and it's extraordinarily complicated to get the regulation right, and few people think we have. Why do we think we can do it with something that's tens of thousands of products delivered completely differently to 315 million people?
Well, the example it made me think of in my own world, you know, in otolaryngology, you know, ear, nose, and throat stuff, we do a lot of sleep apnea surgery and sinus surgery and that kind of stuff. And, you know, in the last, you know, 15 years of my career, there's always been somebody wanting to sell you a new box
or a new device or a new gizmo to let you do what you do better at some level. And when you look at how these things are priced, I mean, the pricing is outrageous. And when you think about it, you realize it's happening exactly the way your thought process would predict, is that they're starting with the fixed price. And they're reverse engineering something that they're calling cost, right, in quotes, cost, and coming up with these ridiculous prices that, you know, and they've figured out that, you know, if you buy the box for $50,000, you'll get a return on investment in 3 years. But they kind of started, they did the whole thing backwards. And when I read the lemonade stand thing, I was like, that's it, in a nutshell.
Well, and I would argue, and it's a very controversial argument, that to your point, Mike, Medicare itself has been the biggest example of what you're talking about. So the argument in Medicare is a very sensible one, which is seniors are more susceptible to having severe health care needs. As a generous society, we will pay for all of the health care our seniors need. And that sounds so sensible. Now, what series of incentives does that set into play? Well, it sets into play the incentive to increase the definition of need. And if you look over the history of the Medicare program, what's most interesting, look, what the policymakers talk about is those places where the spending is just enormous, oh, end-of-life care or one or two specific illnesses. But what's really fascinating is the growth in the amount we spend on seniors who are healthy and seniors who don't have that extreme needs. The growth is absolutely everywhere in the system, and it's a growth of services. Now, I'm not a doctor. I'm not going to pretend to tell you here's what's needed and here's what isn't, but I can tell you a couple of implications we know from this. One is that the error rate in care among seniors is one of the largest causes of their death. It's second or third, depending on how you measure it. That's extraordinary. So just having too much care is in itself a cause of death that has grown enormously over the course of the program. The second is we've got a meaningful percent of seniors, it's roughly 40% over 75, who take a lot of prescription drugs. It's somewhere, I think five or more, and I know five or more is now taken by more than 40% of seniors. A third of them are taking drugs that interfere with another drug that they're taking. And where does that come from? Well, somebody might say, well, that's sloppiness in the system. But I look at it and say, just like the incentives you talk about on the device end for a specific procedure, spread that across an entire economy, and what have you done? You've given people an incentive to say, let's do as much care as we can because it's all paid for. Medicare pats itself on the back by saying, we pay really low prices, and never sort of ask the question of, how do we get away with paying so much lower prices that private insurance pays? Why are they willing to pay more than we are? They tell themselves they're getting a volume discount, but the volume that they don't understand is that the industry understands that Medicare will pay for things that nobody else, no sensible run insurer or buyer or customer would buy. And the result of it is we have now one-third of our seniors who wind up having surgery in the year of their death. Nobody thinks that that number, that incredibly high number, can be explained by anything other than excess medicine.
Well, it makes me think about all those ads on TV for powered wheelchairs. And
they're all for people who don't have to pay for them themselves.
Right.
And, again, many people may need them, and I'm not somebody to say you need this or you don't need this. I'm just making a different point, which is once you say we will pay for all the health care you need, all you have guaranteed is that the industry has an enormous incentive to endlessly expand the definition of need. And I think that is the story of Medicare. And while some of it has obviously been very useful for seniors, particularly seniors of limited means, all seniors are susceptible to a healthcare industry that sees them as enormous revenue opportunities. I'm not sure that's great for their health on balance.
No, it makes me think of an adventure I had in the hospital just last week where I was asked to go and see an elderly patient with a swallowing problem that is fixable by a procedure. And it's a problem that's very common to, you know, patients in their, you know, 70s, 80s, 90s. And the assumption before I walked in the door, this was billed as, we're going to call Dr. K and he's just going to come in here and fix this and you're going to be all better. And when I went in there and said, well, no, I don't think this operation is the right thing for you. I mean, it caused a bit of a of a fuss, a bit of a conundrum, because, you know, I didn't think it was medically appropriate, but when I think about it in terms of you know, the macroeconomics of care, I was kind of bucking this thing that you're talking about, which is, if it's all paid for and it's available, why wouldn't you do it? And it turns out there's often very good reasons not to. So it's
right.
Kind of crazy.
Yeah, and it's as you know, not everybody takes that approach.
No, and I mean, and I probably, you know, walked away from some coin not doing it, but I mean, couldn't look at myself in the mirror if I did it, and I was afraid I was going to, you know, hurt things more than help. But yeah, there is this, you know, and it's, I mean, we can all sort of say it in theory, but every once in a while, you know, when you're the doc, it kind of hits you. You know, we tell stories about individual patients and individual cases, just like you do in the beginning of the book, you know, very personal ones. And, you know, sometimes the individual stories, you know, impress you more than the big ones, just because you can apply the principles in a very sort of real kind of personal way.
And I think that's, you know, something for those folks listening to keep in mind, which is, in healthcare, we so often talk about the big picture. Ignore it. Think about the small picture. I think you see 315 million stories of dysfunction. What we don't have yet is that sense we have in everything else, which is, this dysfunction isn't inevitable. It's not inevitable we get a healthcare system that delivers care at ever greater cost, lack of transparency, confusion, inability to navigate, poor safety record, quality that's erratic, records that are lost, enormous amounts of waiting times, lack of coordination between general specialists, you name it. Everybody's got a story up to, like myself, losing a loved one from an accident or an error. And when I think we start tying those stories that we all know, that little picture, that actual human element that exists, I think, for almost every single one of us, experienced in one form or another, to the broader questions of, do we really want to keep building this massive superstructure that keeps somebody other than us as the accountable customer of the system, that then I think we're actually when we can overcome that sort of psychological barrier of somebody else must be taking care of this for us, we're actually on the road to the kind of change that really can be transformative. Because I can see a healthcare system that's not just higher quality, lower error, and better service, but also a lot cheaper.
Well, I wonder, there was, and I didn't get a chance to pull the entire article, but I did see a reference. You were quoted in a U.S. News and World Report, I think, article within the last 24 or 48 hours. I saw the tweet and read the summary, but I think the gist of the article was that, you know, what you're hoping for, what you're predicting, may actually come to pass through some technologies that are actually, unlike some of these conventional sort of healthcare technologies, are sort of direct-to-consumer technologies. So instead of going through a healthcare system to manage my diabetes, maybe I'll buy a non-invasive glucose monitor directly and wear the darn thing on my wrist and be able to manage things at home and do it in more of a consumer-based model that is going to drive prices down and is going to drive quality. You think that the hope is there, or maybe it's somewhere else, or what?
I think it's an important part of the hope, that point that you raise. I actually am increasingly optimistic for three reasons. One is that ever more insurance policies are, in fact, high-deductible policies, that what we're going to find in a couple of years is that for those of us who are, you know, have normal health care needs, and of course this is all out of the Medicare system, most years we pay for all of our health care out of pocket, and if we buy those policies correctly and set up health savings accounts, should have some resources to do so, and that will really change the incentives for those who serve us to be more normal, more like we see in other industries, and we'll see transformative change from providers having to reach out to those of us with high deductible plans. The second is exactly what you mentioned, which is, at the same time, for a lot of the things that really cause costs or prices to be high in healthcare, which is these diagnostic tests, are not only available in home or remote forms increasingly, but they're cheaper and better, and
yes,
meaningfully cheaper, technology-driven cheaper, not 10% cheaper, but
yeah,
a fraction of the cost of having the healthcare system perform these for us.
And priced
that
has consumers doing it. We're out of time, David. Thank you so much. I appreciate it very much. You've been listening to The Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio.
This is America's Web Radio.com. the best in chat radio designed just for you.